This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to boost your immunity by supporting your GI tract with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll find out how to fix Canada's broken food system with the CEO of Second Harvest, Lori Nickel. We'll discover healthy habits for the new year with naturopath Dr. Kate Hunter. And lastly, we'll learn about the new treatment of fatty liver disease with Dr. James Kim. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Scientists have created new experimental compounds that help brains burn more energy by changing how mitochondria work. Mitochondria are known as the powerhouses of cells because they turn food into energy. In this study, researchers found ways to make mitochondria use fuel less efficiently, causing the body to burn extra calories as heat. This approach could lead to new treatments for obesity and better overall metabolic health. Obesity affects millions of people worldwide and increases the risk of diseases like diabetes and cancer. Many current weight loss drugs require injections and may cause side effects, so safer options are needed. The study was led by the associate professor Tristan Rowling at the University of Technology, Sydney, and published in Chemical Science. The researchers focused on mild mitochondrial uncouplers, which gently increase energy use without harming cells. Older versions of these compounds were dangerous and could cause fatal overheating. By carefully adjusting the chemical structure, scientists created safer compounds that boosted calorie burning while keeping cells healthy. These mild uncouplers may also reduce stress inside cells, helping protect metabolism and possibly slowing aging. While still early, this research offers hope for safer weight loss treatments in the future. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team, headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent and beloved guest on the show. Welcome back, Gordon. How you doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Jamie. It's nice to be back. Just getting over my holiday, as I say.
Yeah. I mean, so many people that I speak with are under the weather, whether it's COVID or the flu, and they're feeling under the weather. So I thought it would be great to bring you in and talk about things that we can do to boost immunity, but more specifically through the GI tract. Sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan. Let's chit-chat about that a bit.
So why is the gastrointestinal tract considered such a critical part of the immune system? We should probably start there.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. If you look at the body, how does bacteria or viruses gain entrance to the body? The one route is through the GI tract, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
The other route is through the lungs, because those are the things that are connected to the outside.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
If you get a cut, that's another route of entry through the skin. Right? So
yes.
Those are the three basic routes, right? And, you know, you could talk about the eyes also, just because the eyes, again, is connected to the outside, right? But But the GI tract is one of the biggest ones because everything goes through the mouth, right? You look at a little kid, the first thing they do is put things in their mouth. Fortunately for us, the immune system is built, has a strong protection on the GI tract. Now, one of the things, the GI tract, fortunately, is very well protected, right? They have, along, when something goes through the mouth, the first place it'll probably hit is the acids in the stomach, right? The acids in the stomach kills off most parasites, kills off most bacteria, kills off most viruses, right? So that's a mechanical protection, right? Then we also have some, we have a little bit of mucus lining the esophagus and so on. And that sort of traps some of the viruses and the bacteria and so on. But again, it just depends on the viral load or the bacterial load. If you have a lot of bacteria coming in, like for example, it gets past the virus, it gets past the acids in the stomach, it goes into the small intestine, right? In the small intestine, there's a whole bunch of, there's things called Peyer's patches where a lot of white blood cells called macrophages hang out. And their basic job is to hang out, and anything that comes in that looks like a bacteria or a virus, it attacks it and eats it up, right? Then there's the other thing that protects it is the probiotics, right? Now, the probiotics, the only thing, the reason we call probiotics good bacteria, and I've constantly said there's nothing inherently good about these probiotics. They don't go to church on Sunday, they don't put extra money in a collection plate, etc. Nothing inherently good. The only reason we call them good bacteria is because the body tolerates them much better than they tolerate the so-called bad bacteria. Okay? Now, how do probiotics help is that what sometimes they're doing by competitive, by just plain competition. There's so many bacteria all over the gut. If the vast majority of them are so-called good bacteria, the bad bacteria come in, they have a very hard time finding a place to set down roots, for want of a better way of saying it, right? And so by competitive exclusion, it keeps a lot of the bacteria out, right? Another thing that probiotics do is that not all of them, okay, some of them do it, not all, they produce their waste products or they produce chemicals, right? Which in turn kills off some of the viruses, kills off some of the bad bacteria. Okay. And sometimes some of these chemicals or substances that they produce, the body absorbs it and utilizes it. It's the only source of some of these things sometimes, right? I don't know if you know, but for certain animals, for example, vitamin B12 is produced by bacteria that's found in the gut, right? If it wasn't for these bacteria, they wouldn't have vitamin B12, right? For humans, there are certain substances that are produced by the bacteria also, right? Which adds to whatever we can get from our food.
So it's symbiotic. In other words,
So it has symbiotic relationship, yeah. But as I said, not every single one does that. So there's different modes of action of these probiotics.
got it. When we talk about probiotics, are you of the school where, you know, we should be looking at specific strains, or should we be looking at sort of a broad variety of probiotics?
I believe in a broad variety, and let me explain why I say that. Specific strains can are not every single strain is found everywhere, right? So if I'm living in Toronto, there's a bacteria milieu or bacteria mixture that you'll find in Toronto that doesn't exist if I was living in New Delhi, India, right? The bacterial strains are different, okay? The bacterial, so if somebody does some work and say, oh, Lactobacillus acidophilus is a great probiotic, right? And I go and I add Lactobacillus acidophilus. First of all, the Lactobacillus has to be able to implant and start to grow, right? And so the analogy I'll use is if I have a lawn and the lawn is full of good grass, good grass, and I want to introduce a new strain of grass in there, it'll have a hard time just because it has to find space so it can start growing somewhere, right? And it takes a sweet time to happen, right? So again, that's why if you go from one place, the bacteria, the good bacteria in your gut will protect you from a lot of foodborne illnesses, right? So the example I use again, not to pick on New Delhi, India, but I know a lot of people could eat street food in New Delhi, India when they live there. They come to Canada, they live here for about 3 or 4 years, right? And then they go back to New Delhi, India. And lo and behold, they try to eat street food and they're sitting on the porcelain throne. It's just because the bacteria, the microbiome has changed, right? And so even if I was to just put one strain of bacteria in there, that one strain is not going to be the be all and the end all and cure every single disease known to man. It's a big mixture. It's a balance you have to try to get to.
What should consumers look for when they're purchasing a probiotic, Gordon?
I would look for something that has multiple strains in one capsule, not a single strain, right? That's the biggest thing. Next thing you should have in there is you should have something, some sort of prebiotic in there also, just to give the bacteria a good head start. The prebiotic, I call a prebiotic something like good fertilizer for the bacteria, something that the bacteria eats. Okay. But I'm going to digress a little bit here. The bacteria that if you're taking good bacteria or any kind of probiotic product, it's a good thing to also eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. The vegetables provide a lot of the fruits and vegetables provide a lot of soluble fiber, and they provide a lot of fiber. Bacteria, that's a food for bacteria. So if you are eating a carnivore diet and you eat no fruits and vegetables and you have no sources of fiber, it's hard pressed for the probiotics to get some sort of traction to start growing, right? So you should also supplement with some sort of a fiber product or something like that, right? So a prebiotic would be something like an inulin or something, or some similar to that.
Can we talk? Can we talk about other things that you might take if you're taking probiotics? Can we talk about the interaction of other types of vitamins?
There's not much, a lot of work done in that area, in all fairness, right? I would be hard pressed to say you need to take this or you need to take that, right? As a thing, but in general, right? It is always good to take a good multivitamin. And the reason I say a multivitamin, if you're healthy, a multivitamin just is extra insurance. If you are coming from the Sudan, where food is hard to come by, right? There's no such thing as bad calories. Any kind of calories you get is good calories. But you need the vitamins and the minerals. And in all fairness, the vitamins and the minerals you get in a multivitamin, if you're coming from the Sudan, is probably not sufficient to keep you in good health, right? For somebody living in North America or Western Europe who eats a full diet, the multivitamin is probably going to be sufficient to keep you going. It's extra insurance.
Can we take a minute and discuss the lifestyle choices that people make and how that might impact the
Okay,
immunity?
when you talk about lifestyle choices, I always like to throw in the exercise card, right? Exercise, there's several things. It helps your peace of mind. It fights stress, which affects the way your gut works, okay? But also with exercise, your body produces more antioxidants, right? Or utilizes antioxidants better. If you tend to exercise, you tend to eat better also, because you're not going to go through all that exercise because it's a lot of work, and eat terribly. You tend to be more mindful of what you eat. So that's one. Secondly, I would also recommend, again, a good multivitamin. And the reason for the good multivitamin, I call it insurance, right? Now, there's a lot of people who will poo-poo the multivitamin. They say, oh, we get everything we need in our food. That might be true if we're eating a fully balanced diet, but how many of us do that, right? So it's a good just insurance to take a good multivitamin. Thirdly, food choices, fruits and vegetables, high fiber, right? If you're eating fruits and vegetables, you will have a high fiber diet, right? But you also need antioxidants, right? Because there's a lot of science out there to show that a lot of diseases, almost every disease known to man, as they always say, is caused by free radicals or made worse by free radicals. So if you have antioxidants, you help control some of that. Last but not least, the antioxidants are also good because it helps control subclinical inflammation. Right now, there's a lot of evidence to show that a lot of diseases started because of low-level inflammation. As an example, the one that this has been published many years ago, like the plaque formation on your blood vessel walls. That is the initial injury is caused by a subclinical inflammation to the wall, and that causes more white cells to come in, which in turn causes the cholesterol to stick on it, right? And that's the start of your plaque, right? That's an example.
For those who are listening and they don't may not know whether or not they have a healthy gut or an unhealthy gut as it pertains to their immune system, what are some of the signs to look for?
I don't think there is a clinical picture that shows that somebody has, you look at them and say, this person has a healthy gut, that person doesn't have a healthy gut. I
Right.
mean, there's some people right off who know. For example, if you have irritable bowel syndrome, you don't have a healthy gut,
I would agree.
right? Now, the question then is that caused by what you eat, caused by your lifestyle choices, or is that something inherently wrong in your biochemistry of the body? It's out there, nobody really knows, right? What I would suggest for people who think they don't have a healthy gut, eat better, fruits and vegetables, higher fruits and vegetables, take a good probiotic. What I'm trying to say is stack the cards in your favor.
That makes a lot of sense. I agree. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jamie, for having me again.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to fix Canada's broken food system on The Tonic. This just in. Time thieves have been spotted across Canada. We've received reports of influencers and content creators stealing countless precious hours from hardworking citizens everywhere. Reports indicate thousands of hours worth of pickleball games, Pilates classes, and shooting hoops have been stolen thus far. Authorities are urging Canadians to stay alert and protect their physical activity time. Let's make room to move. Brought to you by Participaction. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Lori Nichol is a visionary leader and leading advocate for social and environmental justice in the food system, widely recognized for transforming how Canada addresses food loss and waste. An international thought leader in perishable food recovery, her work focuses on raising awareness of the climate impacts of food loss while driving practical system-wide solutions. Her leadership has earned global recognition, including being named Canada's Food Hero by the United Nations, a Clean 50 recipient, one of Canada's Women of Influence, one of Waterstone Capital's most admired CEOs, and appointment to the Order of Ontario in 2022. As CEO of Second Harvest, Lori has built a national food recovery network that redistributes healthy surplus food to thousands of communities across Canada. Welcome to the show, Lori. How are you?
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to discuss some of the challenges facing Canada's food system in terms of waste and food loss. So from your perspective, what do you think the biggest problems are?
We have an enormous food waste challenge in this country. I mean, we have a global food waste challenge, but the amount of food that is wasted in this country is about $58 billion worth, and it's enough to feed everybody. And so it's unfortunate that we have a food insecurity crisis on our hands, while at the same time we have so much food that is totally edible, healthy, good food that we could be eating.
So when we talk about food that's going to waste, to my mind, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's like when you see produce at the store that eventually becomes perhaps less attractive and, you know, gets brown or whatever. And I guess, I presume it gets thrown away. Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about something else?
No, and I really appreciate you saying that, like outlining it that way, because I think you're not alone. That's what most people think food waste is, because you're thinking about it in your household. When I'm talking about food waste, I'm talking about the entire supply chain. And so what I think of is there's standards, criteria for carrots. So if you have a crooked carrot, you can't sell it necessarily. Or there's just an overproduction of food in general. Full stop. So we might get a call that says we have 3 million pounds of potatoes. Like, try to visual 3 million pounds of potatoes. Like, you can't, it's enormous. And so we have to say, okay, because it was just an overproduction this year. It was a booming year for potatoes. So we're really looking at it really high up the supply chain, like from farms, from manufacturers, from distribution centers, retail. There is household that has to be managed, but at Second Harvest, we're really looking at that systems issue across the supply chain from farm to retail.
When you speak about the supply chain, are you talking about national or provincial or both?
Both.
Okay.
And international, right? Like,
and that was my next question, right?
Yes.
So like, are you concerned at all? I mean, obviously you are philosophically, but the work that you do, does it pertain to the international problem of that we're discussing now? Like,
of course. I mean, we work internationally in a number of ways, but for sure, the tariffs is a huge concern. We actually put out a tariff report almost immediately after we heard about it. We did some research on it. We haven't been impacted that much yet, but we have been in terms of, I'm talking about Canada, not Second Harvest necessarily.
Yeah.
We have been, but just the uncertainty of it all also has a huge impact that I don't know that everybody would understand how that impacts food, because it means you're not maybe growing because you're not sure if you're going to have the customer. You know, the steel is really impacting logistics. So buying a truck now, I used to be able to buy a truck for 150. Now it's 270, I think. So those pieces are impacting us, but just general uncertainty is very concerning. And you're seeing it, right? Like, even at the grocery store, our prices are going up, and they have been going up since COVID. But like, we're hoping for that to lessen, right? So there is a bunch of food waste. Food is becoming really unaffordable for many Canadians. And so how do we work together to just kind of connect those dots while we work on food insecurity, real solutions, which is economic. People should have money in their pockets to buy the food that they need. They shouldn't be using the surplus food. And the surplus food, we should be looking at prevention. Why are we getting this much anyway? Like, how do you prevent this at source so we don't have it, full stop?
So let's focus on that for a quick sec. So if we're talking about overproduction or the wrong amount of production, what can we do? Is it a question of coordinating who's growing what crops?
Honestly, the simple answer for this is measure it.
Okay.
And set a goal, right? So we, in 2015, Canada made a commitment to the UN that we would halve food waste by 2030. Well, Canada doesn't actually measure food waste. It's not mandated to measure it. So how are you going to hit a goal that you don't understand because nobody's measuring it? So just a simple, here's a goal, everybody. We're going to figure out at the farm level what kind of supports you need. And, you know, there's going to be capital expenditures that are required. How do we support that? And also, like, big businesses, maybe you just have to do it and you have enough money to do it yourself. But this is the goal. You're going to do this with your food waste. First, we have to understand how much do you have?
Right.
And then we say, okay, how do you manage it? And honestly, there's a huge economic benefit to managing food waste in industry. So we are seeing it's getting better. Like, we did our first research, Canadian research, and we were the first ones to do it on food waste at Second Harvest. And it was 58% of all food produced for Canadians, 58% was lost or wasted across the supply chain. And so 5 years later, so 2025, we said, let's see if it's getting better. And I will say, I'm happy to report it is. We're at about 46%. Unfortunately, the avoidable stuff, which is avoidable, is the stuff that we can eat, is actually higher. So we have work to do, but it is getting better. Industry is seeing that it's better for their bottom line.
Okay, so we have this immense problem, and you've reduced some of that wastage on a percentage basis. What policies drove that? Is that having farmers grow different crops?
No. It's just industry looking at their management systems, like seeing where they can. I think honestly, nobody was talking about food waste. Like 10 years ago, it wasn't even a conversation. And so now that there's way more awareness about it, people are doing things about it. Like nobody grows food or, produces food or manufactures food just to waste it. That's nobody's intent. But nobody was really looking at it to see how much they actually had and how they could mitigate that as much as possible. So it's not growing different things. It really is looking at your business model of where is the waste happening. Like you're always going to have some food waste, right? Like there's going to be bumper crops, right? You've made a commitment to whatever retailer or manufacturer that you're going to have X amount of potatoes or carrots or whatever. So you're always going to have to overgrow a little bit just to make sure you meet your commitments, but not as much as we do. And that's across, like that's everywhere. But I would argue one of the biggest challenges is these arbitrary best before dates. So once the food is produced, we're throwing so much food across the supply chain away because of a very arbitrary best before date that is not mandated by CFIA. They are voluntary, put on by businesses. They're very conservative and really misunderstood.
That's really interesting because, it's a household debate whether or not you can have the eggs or the milk after it's been stale dated. So what would you tell the consumer about that?
Well, here's the rules. If a product has a shelf life of 90 days or less, a best before date is required. So you're talking about like anything perishable, basically,
Right.
milk, eggs, all that. They're conservative, but you need to, look at them. Everything else is voluntary and does not require one. And so best before is really about the optimum nutrition and peak freshness of that product. It doesn't become poisonous after that date. Like it doesn't
Right.
make you sick, right? Like it's just not at its optimum best. So I would say if you're looking at best before dates, look at the stuff that's in your cupboards first, right? Let's look at your cans of things
Right.
because people are throwing that away, or cereal or pasta that's dry. Don't throw that away. Man, that stuff will last you for years and years and years. When you're looking at perishable, use your common sense. Like when milk has gone off, whether the best before date is before or after that, you will notice. If you're talking about meat, yeah, eat it on the best before date or before, but you can just throw it in the freezer. And then it just stops, right? So it's not, if it's frozen, you're fine. The best before date will last longer. And that's true for pretty much every food. If you think you're not going to eat it, just throw it in the freezer and it will last.
Yeah, but even, not to undermine your point, but, even putting things in the freezer, there's only so much, you can't keep meat indefinitely in your freezer, right?
No, 100%. But you also have, like, again, I'm going to go back to people's common sense. Like, you're going to look at something that's freezer burnt and go, I'm not going to eat that. And I think you're not going to say, well, the date says I can eat it, so I'm going to eat it, even though it smells off, it looks off. You're not going to. So I think we just have to remember, best before dates came around in the 70s. They haven't been around from infinitum. And so I think we have to just remember, we know when food's off, right? We should know. So best before dates with a grain of salt.
Can you come and tell this to my wife? That would be really
100%.
really helpful. So you mentioned something off the top, and I want to circle back to it. And that's kind of like wonky fruits and vegetables. They don't look pretty, but they are nutritionally sound. So
Exactly.
how do we deal with that? I know there have been some programs where, like, for example, food retailers will put out the wonky fruit at a discount and stuff like that. What do you recommend?
I think that's great. Any way that we can, I think as consumers, there's this kind of push-pull, right? So retail is saying consumers don't want it. Consumers, I think, don't really care. If you go to Europe, they have wonky food. So there are some standards that you need, but some standards that are absolutely ridiculous in terms of it has to be a certain degree of crookedness, if there's any at all. So there's one is standards that we have across, like that are Canadian government standards. They need to be readdressed. And then there's just the retailer purchasing these things to sell to consumers, and giving us all some credit, right? We will eat the food. We will eat what's there. We eat it at a farmer's market, right? So there's no big shift when it's at the grocery store, although there is. If the grocery store has to look beautiful, it's bountiful. Like there is some research that says if the shelves aren't full and overflowing, people buy less. I have seen that. But it's not necessarily like we can adapt. We will buy crooked, carrots at a farmer's market, And we buy ginger in all kinds of shapes and we don't even think about it. So I think we have to retrain our brains a little bit about food and what the purpose is. And that is to keep us alive, to keep us healthy, to get the nutrients out of it, to connect people. It doesn't really matter if your carrot is crooked, if you're going to, it doesn't matter if it is regardless, but you're likely going to throw it in a stew or something anyway. So,
Agreed.
yes.
The other thing that you mentioned off the top is, the increasing price of food. And, if you were in charge of everything, what would you do to help ameliorate, what appears to be, rampant inflation when it comes to the food that we eat?
Well, I don't think, I mean, yes, I would like food costs to come down. And, there are some strategies out there and there are some apps out there that will allow people to buy food at discount. So it's not that it's not available. But in general, I would say the bigger challenge is actually income for people. A lot of people have enough income that they're not thinking about it. I mean, we're all thinking about it to some extent, but some people, this really does impact what they're able to buy. And at Second Harvest, we're all about healthy, perishable food. Like most of our food is protein, dairy, and produce. Those are the foods you need to stay healthy. But when you're low income, you're gravitating towards what's cheapest. And so that's really an income issue. Like we need to figure out how do we ensure that everybody, and like all these children as well, have the best start or have the best life and have the best access to healthy food regardless. And that's like a bigger issue, income and gig work. And people that are using food banks and food charities, many of them have jobs. It's a very different profile than we would have seen 10 years ago of people accessing these things. People with university degrees, people with two jobs, people with homes, right? So it's just very different in terms of income. So right now, hey, let's try to figure out how to get food to them, but that's not a solution. Like Second Harvest is not a solution, a long-term solution. Our long-term solution is reduce at source food waste so there's no food waste. But that doesn't solve the income issue for Canadians that really are struggling to buy food, enough of it, the right quantity and the right quality. So how, that's a bigger issue. And I'll be quite honest with you, it's too big a problem for me to solve. And I really work with mostly with the food banks because they are doing some really great advocacy and policy work on that. So I support all of it. But at Second Harvest, our policy work is very geared towards food waste.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to explain.
Well, thank you so much.
That was Lori Nickel. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss healthy habits for the new year on The Tonic.
'Feeling low on energy? Orange Naturals can help. For over 15 years, Orange Naturals has been making family-friendly natural health supplements, including their B-complex with L-theanine, right here in Canada. This synergistic blend of full-spectrum active B vitamins boosts energy production by helping you metabolize carbs, fats, and proteins more efficiently. Plus, each dose contains 200 milligrams of L-theanine to promote relaxation without reducing alertness. Find Orange Naturals B-Complex at grocery stores like Loblaws and Metro, pharmacies like Shoppers Drug Mart and Rexall, or online at well.ca and orangenaturals.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Kate Hunter is a licensed naturopathic doctor practicing in Ontario since 2012. Dr. Kate has a clinical interest in complex cases such as autoimmune conditions, GI issues, hormone imbalances, fertility support, and chronic pathologies, just to name a few. In her practice, she uses auricular and bioenergetic medicine, which is a combination of traditional Chinese medicine plus diagnosis and biofeedback response to test and reestablish the body's ability to self-heal and auto-regulate. In her free time, she's an avid runner and skier and loves being outside with her young kids, enjoying nature. Welcome back to the show and Happy New Year, Kate.
Thanks, Jamie. Happy New Year.
So we were speaking a bit before coming on the show, and 2025, what were you telling me about 2025?
So 2025, a friend told me that it was the year of the snake. So it was the year to get rid of old habits, things that weren't working for you in 2025.
Yeah.
And the 2026 apparently is the year of the horse. So this is new beginnings, fresh starts.
And betting on horse races too?
Yeah, totally. Giddy up.
So, you know, so this time of year, everybody has the best of intentions. And also, like, philosophically, it's almost like, you know, you're encouraged to make changes, right? Like, and from your perspective, is there a way to do it correctly?
I think January can be daunting for a lot of people because I think people sort of, you know, reassess and take stock of their life and what's healthy and not healthy. But I think that the simplest thing that I tell my patients, instead of worrying about taking all these things away and stopping all these things, is adding in simple, healthy habits.
When I think of habit, I think it's something that it has some like sort of depth to it, right? Like it isn't something you're going to do once or twice. It's like a lifestyle choice.
Right. It's like a continual practice of health for longevity, I would hope.
Yeah. So practice, I like that word. That's what I look at. Like I'm actually not a huge fan of resolutions. So let's not frame it that way. Because I think most people give up on their resolutions. It's to me, it's kind of meaningless. And it's goal-oriented, which I think for a lot of people is daunting, which is, I think, what you're getting at. Whereas making decisions to do things differently is probably, hopefully, sustainable, right?
Yeah. And I think weight loss is always sort of one of those huge goals for people come January.
Yeah.
So I think people, you know, traditionally, you know, take out gluten, take out dairy, cut their calories in half, exercise 2 times a day, which is just not sustainable. A change that big from your norm is never going to be sustained. So I like to tell my patients, just gradually introduce a few really healthy things instead of focusing on taking things away and paring things down, adding some healthy habits.
So what are one or two of these habits or choices or processes that give us sort of the biggest bang for the buck? Let's call it that way.
Yeah, I think one that I think it is really sort of easy and people like to get in the rhythm of it is a really good morning routine. So I think everyone is really accustomed to waking up, dragging their feet out of bed and instantly making a coffee.
Yep.
So if we can make that, if I can make that coffee better for you and more of like a health start to your day, then you're just taking a habit that you're already accustomed to and adding wellness to it. So I, in the morning with my coffee, I make, you know, half a decaf espresso, half a caffeinated espresso, add some oat milk, and then I add lion's mane tincture, which is a mushroom to help with focus and mental clarity. Mm-hmm. I add chaga, which is also a mushroom that helps with vitality and energy levels. I add vitamin D into that. I also add, depending on how I'm feeling, sometimes a bit of viral support. So I make my morning coffee sort of like a super coffee. So even if, you know, I'm busy and tired, at least I'm still starting with a bit of a health foundation every morning.
You mentioned lion's mane tincture. I read an article this weekend. I can't remember if it was in the Globe or the Times, where somebody was actually adding that to like cocktails of all things.
Oh, I love it.
Isn't that crazy?
Well, actually, that would be unfortunately, one of the things that I would say to shed.
Yeah, I know.
Or get rid of for 2026 is alcohol. It just has such a detrimental effect on health. If you could get rid of one thing to improve your health immensely, it would be get rid of alcohol. And one thing I think to improve your health overall would be like a simple morning routine is great, but I think if you're going to do one thing, would be a really good probiotic to work on the microbiome.
Yep. So let's talk about daily routines regarding energy and digestion and stress. How can we build upon those without feeling overwhelmed? Like I find like as I'm getting older, there's just like more things that I have to do. Do you know what I mean?
And more supplements you should be taking.
Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. I'm up to 7 now daily. So, you know.
Yeah. And like that's pretty normal. Like I think it depends on like age and health status, but yeah. I like to look at the body for like, what organs do you want to support? Like what are, you know, your most vital organs for longevity? So gut health is a super important one because it dictates inflammation in your body. It has so much to do with brain health as well. So a good probiotic, I think, is a great baseline. Mm-hmm. Liver for longevity and general health is also so important. It filters all your toxins. It does all the detoxification in your body. It also filters and converts all your hormones. So I think a good liver support is something that I usually have patients on long-term maintenance. So something like a Liv Complex, something that's high in milk thistle. And then gut, liver, and then yeah, brain health. I think brain health is also really kind of, it's got a lot of buzz right now, but essential fatty acids to decrease inflammation, lion's mane to increase cognition and mental clarity. I think, you know, those are the three organs that I'm going to focus on myself for this coming year.
I won't say I doom scroll, but I think the state of affairs in the world is probably impacting all of us, you know, whether it's tariffs or fears of invasion or whatever it might be. I just think everybody's more stressed out. It's manifesting in so many different ways, like road rage and anxiety and general bad behavior and uncouthness. So how can we deal with stress? What would you recommend? Because I think it's such an important part of our health.
Absolutely. That's a good point. I probably should have added adrenal glands into my organ list. The adrenal glands secrete cortisol, which is your stress hormone. And I think just sort of systemically, we all are secreting it too much, too long all the time, specifically doom scrolling, right? When you're home, you're supposed to be resting, you're on your phone and you're spiking your cortisol. So there's a lot of different herbs and a lot of different supplements to support the adrenal glands. Ashwagandha is a really common herb that's used to decrease cortisol levels and manage those. L-theanine is also a really beautiful one, and GABA. Those help modulate the neurotransmitters that calm your system. So I think we should just literally put all three of those in the water in Toronto, but there's a lot of different supplements that focus on that. And then as far as daily practices to decrease stress, I think less screen time, more quiet. I feel like it's kind of a no-brainer, but more time in nature, more time meditating, all those things, just less screens.
Yeah. Can I add a few to that list? Would you mind?
Please. Yes.
So I'm of a certain age where I need to do a lot more stretching when I'm exercising, and I'm kind of using that time as that non-screen relaxation time, right? So it's like you stretch out before you exercise. I know you're a runner. You stretch out beforehand, you know, to prevent injury. But after building up a sweat, I find going to the mat and stretching out. My mantra is counting to 30 when I'm holding my stretches. But if you don't have time to meditate, you know, maybe you have time to stretch and kind of clear your mind at the same time.
Or maybe you have time to sauna. I've been saunaing quite a bit. And even just 10, 20 minutes in the sauna, if you can just close your eyes and deep breathe, it's pretty much a 2-for-1, because sauna is just so beneficial for overall well-being and longevity.
And it's one thing to say no screen time, but I've taken it a step further. I mean, my kids are mostly out of the house, but no screen time with the evening meal. It's one thing to read the paper in the morning, but no phones at dinner.
100% agree.
So I don't know. I don't know if that helps anybody. And in terms of getting outside in nature, get a dog. I walk my dog.
Get a dog. Yes, we got a dog in March, and it has been, I think, one of the most grounding things I've done. Everyone was like, oh no, not a puppy. It's going to be so much work. But it actually forces you to go outside, forces you to not be in front of a screen and just ground yourself and be in nature. I agree.
And how many new neighbors have you met?
So many. Absolutely. And with all these, you know, happiness studies and these happiness researchers, one of the main things they say that is best for happiness is talking to strangers. And I really agree. I found that with a dog.
Yeah. I'm dating myself again. I'm the king of Kensington of my neighborhood now. Everybody knows me and my dog because we go on multiple walks a day, and she's a real cutie. And I've met so many people that otherwise I don't think I would have.
We should go on a dog walk.
Absolutely. So for those who may have fallen off track before, in other words, finding, you know, these new lifestyle choices, making them sustainable, what's your best advice to keep people going?
Yeah, just small, simple additions. So we talked about the morning routine. It could be in a coffee. It could be in a tea. You could even do a healthy water. So lemon with those mushrooms that I spoke about, some vitamin D in your water, just having something to start your day that isn't immediately caffeine and a screen. And I think diet wise, I think a lot of people, you know, look at January as weight loss. And I think an easy way is to just basically look at every single plate as one half and two quarters and try to fill every plate, the half of every plate, with greens. So it doesn't matter what kind of meal you're having, breakfast, lunch, dinner, half of that plate needs to be greens, ideally healthy protein for the quarter and healthy grain for the other quarter. And just having that consistently as your base for three meals a day will help weight loss, longevity, all the things.
I'm going to add two more if that's okay with you.
Yes, please.
So my Waterloo is eating late at night. So it's a complete food ban. I'm not permitted in the kitchen after dinner. and because it's a slippery slope for me. Once I'm in there, God knows what's going to happen.
Yes.
So I keep out of there. The other thing is I'm going to be doing a bucket list trip to Japan later this year.
Amazing.
And I was reading about a philosophy that they have, which sounds pretty cool. And it is you eat to 80%. Like you don't eat till you're full. You eat to your like 80% full. I don't know how you gauge that. I'll have to ask them when I get there. But apparently you eat to 80% fullness. So you're always like a little bit hungry. But you can eat whatever you want, you know, as long as there's some nutrition in there. And then in that way, you're not necessarily counting calories. You're just kind of listening to your body.
Right. I heard actually one of my old professors had this theory, and I don't know if he made it up or if he heard it, but he called it trust the burp. The first time you burp when you're eating, that indicates you're full. And most people go way past that.
I would agree. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
That was Dr. Kate Hunter. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll talk about the treatment of fatty liver disease on The Tonic. Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, or MASH, and sometimes referred to as fatty liver, is a chronic progressive metabolic disease which can be potentially life-threatening if not properly managed. It's estimated that one in three who are overweight or obese will be impacted by MASH. Up until now, treatment options have been limited, but this month, semaglutide drug called Wegovy has been approved by Health Canada for the treatment of MASH, giving hope to thousands of people. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. James Kim, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Calgary and an expert on MASH. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kim. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me.
So what is MASH exactly?
Yeah, so a MASH is essentially an inflammation of the liver. It's like having hepatitis A or B, where those are viruses causing the liver inflammation, but this is driven by the metabolic issues such as diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, or high cholesterol. So basically what happens is that when excess amount of fat deposits in the liver, it starts causing inflammations around the fat tissue in the liver. After a while, then it starts causing inflammation of the liver and eventually scarring of the liver, which can eventually lead to, funny enough, I know it's a liver disease, but it can actually cause a heart disease, and it can also cause a liver issues such as cirrhosis and liver cancer.
So how do people develop this condition typically?
So there are about seven different major factors that contributes in development of MASH, such as genetics and gut microbiomes and so on. However, the main driver is the metabolic issues such as obesity. As a matter of fact, actually overweight as well, and diabetes and prediabetes, high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And that along with the other major factors are basically what causes the development of MASH.
So the type of fat that we're talking about, is that the subcutaneous fat?
So thank you for clarifying. This is a very good question. So no, those are the visceral fats. So the fats, when they stay where it's supposed to be, well, it's not very good for a number of reasons. There are certain fats that actually cause So hormonal issues, and it actually increases the insulin resistance. And when those fats actually get deposited into the other places, such as liver in this case, but it can also get deposited in the heart, then it can do the same thing. It can cause inflammations and then and cause scarring. So these are the visceral fats.
Why is it that the rates of MASH are increasing in Canada? Is it really our lifestyle, or is there something more to it?
So yes, and there are more to it. Yes. So the main real issues are the diabetes and obesity. So those are the two main drivers of MASH, not just in Canada, actually around the world. So many people with diabetes, especially with type 2 diabetes and obesity, actually have MASH. And the worst part is that most of them actually don't even know that they have MASH. And with these two main drivers of MASH are on the rise, that's why we think the MASH rate is going to increase. As a matter of fact, one of the world's obesity organization predicted that over 40% of Canadian adults will be obese by 2030. That is just 4 years time. I mean, that's crazy. Now, for those of you who think that that is a far-fetched idea, well, I can tell you that over 40% of adults living in New Brunswick have already have obesity, and they have reached that a couple of years ago. So with the rate of obesity and going up, diabetes rate will also follow, which means that the two main drivers of the MASH are increasing, which means that the MASH rate will increase too. So yes, then as you know, with the diabetes and obesity, there are a lot of lifestyle issues too, but there are also non-lifestyle issues that are increasing the rates of diabetes and obesity.
What are some of those non-lifestyle issues? Is it genetics, or is there something else going on?
Yes, so genetics actually play a huge role as well. So for example, 10% of the MASH patients are actually very lean, and they may not actually have diabetes as well. So we call them lean MASH patients. And we do feel that especially in those patients, two main genetics genes are actually playing a role, and also along with our gut microbiomes and so on.
So you mentioned earlier that people don't know that they have it. Mm-hmm. How is it typically diagnosed, and how has it historically been treated?
So historically, it's been very poor. And we feel that it is because of the lack of knowledge and understanding of these conditions by not just the patients, but also by the healthcare professionals. And that has been shown in one of the Canadian study and also other studies around the world, where the healthcare professionals don't quite appreciate and understand the importance of MASH. So it has been very poorly diagnosed in the past, and a lot of healthcare professionals relied on the blood test to check for the liver. And if the blood test for the liver has been deranged, then we would consider that the patients may have MASH. But many research actually have shown that many people with MASH actually have normal blood tests for the liver. So therefore, we have missed a lot of those patients. And some of these patients are diagnosed through the liver ultrasound, which is definitely not an accurate way of diagnosing MASH. But we didn't really have much access to things like a FibroScan. So those are special scans where we can actually diagnose MASH, or liver biopsy would be the other options. We didn't really have guideline to guide healthcare professionals in terms of how to diagnose MASH as well. And some research around the world actually have shown that many patients are actually diagnosed with the advanced form of MASH in ER, when the MASH have gone unnoticed for many years and the liver becomes cirrhotic or develop end-stage cancer. And then many patients actually present to ER with those symptoms. So we haven't been doing great jobs. In terms of treatment, the only treatment that we had really was the weight loss. And that was it, really. But you and I, and actually everybody who's listening, probably know how easy it is to lose weight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I had my New Year resolution of losing some pounds, which I gave up in day two, because weight loss is not easy. It's very easy for us to say, but to actually follow it is not. Definitely through the lifestyle, it's not easy. And as we get older, it becomes harder and harder. And the other thing is that certain dietary recommendations have been very difficult to follow. So one dietary recommendation that have been proven to help with people with MASH is Mediterranean diet. I'm Asian, and I'm from Korea, and you tell Korean patients to follow the Mediterranean diet, that usually don't go well because it is very, very difficult. So we haven't really figured out a way to customize some of these diets to the patient's cultural and religious belief. So it's been a bit tough in the past.
Okay, so understanding that, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that the liver is an organ that can actually repair itself. It is regenerative, correct?
That's correct, yes.
So presumably, is MASH reversible? In other words, if you do the right things, can we stop it?
So yes. So this is really, really fascinating because we always felt that if the MASH is very advanced, then, for example, if the liver is cirrhotic, then that's it. Your liver is fried and there is no way back. However, more recent studies through lifestyle modifications have shown that some of these cirrhotic patients are able to reverse some of the fibrosis, so liver scarring and MASH as well. So that's been really encouraging. There's one particular medication that is being researched at the moment where they are researching in people with cirrhosis. That's pretty advanced MASH fibrosis or the scarring of the liver.
Yep.
And they are actually reversing some of these processes. So it's really exciting. So the answer is yes. How much, I guess, we'll see as more researchers are coming out. But yeah, very, very exciting time to live right now.
And I understand there's more good news because a new evidence-based pharmacological treatment option has just been approved, which we mentioned off the top. So can you elaborate on that? It's Wegovy, and maybe you could explain to the listeners how this all comes about.
Oh, this is really, really exciting. Wegovy, basically, it's same as Ozempic, but at a higher dose and indicated for weight loss only, not for diabetes. And now that has been approved for the treatment of MASH. It's the first time in Canada that any drug has been formally approved for MASH. It's so exciting. It helps to reduce the fat content of the liver as well as the scarring of the liver. So the actual MASH can be reversed as well. This can potentially save patients' lives from heart disease. As a matter of fact, 70% of the people living with MASH actually have heart disease, and most of them actually die from heart disease. And it can also protect them from the liver disease and also reduce the potential liver transplant as well. It's so exciting. An amount of money, the healthcare cost that we can save can be quite astonishing as well. Many patients with MASH actually have, I don't know if this is the right word, but a crappy quality of life. They can get very fatigued, and the healthcare costs for people living with MASH can be actually quite bad. But if you can actually manage these patients, identify them early on, and treat them with medication like Wegovy, this can be an absolute real deal breaker for many people living with MASH or people who are at risk of developing MASH.
So when you talk about people at risk of developing MASH, are you suggesting that Wegovy could be used preemptively as a precautionary drug, or am I misunderstanding you?
So for example, if you have a patient who has type 2 diabetes and obesity who may not have MASH at the moment, we could potentially use medication like Wegovy, and we can potentially prevent them from getting into MASH or advanced MASH. Actually, MASH falls under the umbrella term of a MASLD, which I don't have time to go into. So even if you have some fatty deposition in the liver and you have like type 2 diabetes and obesity, then you can actually use medication like Wegovy potentially to prevent them from actually going into MASH and have liver scarring. So it can be very, very exciting.
One last question, and that is, what would you like listeners who might be at risk of MASH to know?
Okay, really, really important. So for any of you who have pre-diabetes, diabetes, overweight, obesity, high cholesterol, or high blood pressure, then please see your doctor and ask them to check you for MASH. There is a very simple blood test that can rule you out of MASH. In other words, if you do a certain blood test and if your numbers are very low, then chance of you having MASH is very, very low. And if the number is very high, then chance of you having MASH is actually quite high. So very, very, very simple test. And this simple blood test can improve your health, your liver health, and most importantly, your overall quality of life. So please, 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 I beg you, please.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Lori Nickel, Dr. Kate Hunter, and Dr. James Kim. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contest prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin, wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.